I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. If you live in Kansas City, Missouri, you may have noticed that your water bill is going up and up and up again. Today we learn what an arrangement between the city and the Environmental Protection Agency has to do with it. Then our ethics professors return to the show. They'll give us their musings on a gun ban at an NRA convention. It's got people asking if the vice president deserves more protection than American school children. We'll also consider the government's role in dictating what food people can and can't buy with welfare dollars. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's not news to Kansas Cityans that their water bills have risen and risen again and again. But is there relief in sight? The answer is a qualified maybe. Now a conversation about the cause of the city's skyrocketing water rates and what the city is doing to help. With us is Andy Shively. He's a special assistant city manager and the city's point person on all things consent decree with this the city's massive sewer project. Andy, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me on your show.
You know, there's some history here, some dirty history when it comes to the city's water, Andy. Kansas City historically was dumping a lot of very dirty water into this world. Tell us about that and what the federal government decided to do about it.
So Kansas City's wastewater infrastructure is about 150 years old. Mm. So we have a combined sewer system here in Kansas City, covers about 58 square miles of the city. And it's at those locations.
Meaning combined means that
one pipe carries both wastewater and then during a wet weather event or during rainfall, it also carries the rainwater as well.
Yeah.
And it's those pipes you have combined sewer overflows. It's those outfalls that cause the discharge. So in a typical year, it's about 6.4 billion gallons of combined sewer overflow that is discharged to our local streams and rivers.
Say that again, 6.4 billion gallons?
6.4 billion gallons.
That's a lot of water. That's what dirties Brush Creek, for example, right?
Yes. Yeah. That is correct.
And that's still happening even today.
That is correct.
When did the government step in and say, enough's enough?
Kansas City signed its consent decree, or was entered into, on September 27th, 2010. It's a 25-year consent decree, so it runs through 2035. We've completed 7 years of that, and we are now in year eight of that 25-year program. It is about $4.5 to $5 billion program to meet the requirements of the Clean Water Act.
And basically, we have to separate the stormwater from the wastewater. Do I have that right?
We are doing very little separation. So if you allow me to talk in round numbers, we have 58 square miles of combined sewer system in Kansas City, and we're separating about 5 square miles.
So what is the whole point then? What's the project, all these billions of dollars, what's it going to accomplish?
It's going to reduce the volume and frequency of combined sewer overflows, separate sanitary sewer overflows, and meet the requirements of the Clean Water Act.
And how do you do that? How do you make sure that there won't be overflows as a result of this project?
We're taking several different approaches. We're using green infrastructure to capture the rainwater before it enters the combined sewer system to reduce the volume and frequency of overflows in that manner. We're using inline storage to store that volume within the existing collection system because there is capacity within the certain parts of the collection system, and that's a very cost-effective way by holding those flows back. And it uses a very neat technology called real-time decision support systems. So it's making those decisions, monitoring the level within the sewers, and then releases those flows before it causes backups.
And we need reservoirs to hold that water then, don't we?
There's also storage solutions. So green infrastructure is called distributed storage. There's actually gray infrastructure solutions. But really what we want to focus on in Kansas City is it's fixing the infrastructure that we have now and build as little new infrastructure as possible, because new infrastructure makes your O&M costs go, your operations and maintenance costs go up. And we already have a gap between the amount of funds available and what is needed, so it makes more sense to fix the infrastructure and utilize our existing assets to the maximum extent possible.
How much of it, you mentioned this gap in funding, how much of a gap are we looking at here?
Well, so far, we are about $500 million in on our $4.5 billion program. So we have another $4 billion to go, and I'm using round numbers,
sure,
if that's okay. So, and that funding is a part of the water bill, and that's how we're funding these improvements in Kansas City. And I think the good news is that the mayor, the council, the city manager, they have not only heard Kansas City's concerns regarding their water bill, they have listened, and they have asked that we go back and negotiate with the Environmental Protection Agency to find a more cost-effective, sustainable program that meets the requirements of the Clean Water Act, but does so in a more affordable way.
Does that mean extending the 25-year length of this program to 30 or 35 years, Andy?
It could. It could mean that. It could mean let us use the data and the technology that's available in 2018 to help solve this problem and meet the requirements of the Clean Water Act. So we know more in 2018 than what was known in 2008. And as you know, technology is constantly evolving. And so we want to utilize data and technology to drive our, and prioritize those capital improvements in order to reduce that volume and frequency of our sewer overflows here in Kansas City.
Andy, what incentive does the EPA have to come back to the table and renegotiate with Kansas City? I mean, this deal's in place. Everybody knew it would result in higher water bills. Kansas City had delayed the implementation of any kind of agreement for a bunch of years. So why should the EPA play ball with us right now?
That's a great point, and I'm glad you bring that up. The EPA is often referred to as a faceless organization in context. But the reality is we work with people, and I have the privilege of working with a great team in Region 7, so that's where Kansas City is located, within EPA's Region 7. So it's my privilege to work with them, and they live and work in this region too, and they're just as concerned with the rising water bills as well. So it's a collaborative effort. It's a team effort, and I think we're all pulling in the same direction to find the best plan for Kansas City in 2018.
So they recognize that the water rates have gone up to levels that a lot of folks are really struggling with out there, and they recognize that perhaps a change has to be made.
Absolutely. They are sensitive to that. They understand the residents' concerns, and they're a public agency as well. And what they do is really self-evident by the agency's name, right? They're the Environmental Protection Agency. But I think what often is lost in that conversation is that it's also to protect public health and safety. And that's our role. Water quality is not just a 25-year concern from 2010 to 2035. It's a 24/7, 365 concern. And we are all working towards that same direction. We have the same goal. I often state that, and I pose it in the form of a question. I say, what is our most precious resource? And most civil engineers will blurt out, well, water is our most precious resource. And I challenge them and say, actually, people are our most precious resource. It's why we do what we do. We serve them. We're public servants. And we need to remember that the most important part of that, being a public servant, is the servant portion. That's what we're here to do, is to serve the people. They are our most precious resource. It's why we care about water quality 24/7, 365. And the EPA has the exact same goal. And so it's great working with them. And it's my pleasure to sit down at the table, not on the opposite side of the table, but on the same side of the table as we work hard towards developing the best plan for Kansas City going forward.
We're talking about Kansas City's massive sewer project, a $4.5 billion program in response to a federal government consent decree. So ultimately, Andy, are we talking about the possibility of a reduction in water rates or just not increasing them any further from where they are now? What's the goal of this renegotiation?
The goal is to level out the rates. So as you know, they have been increasing steadily over the last 9 years. And so there will not be a reduction in rates because we still have 150-year-old wastewater infrastructure that was not addressed for decades. Mm-hmm. Actually, they kicked the can down the road for 140 years, I would argue. Wow. Just in the last 10 years has there been a concerted effort in reinvesting in the infrastructure we have. And so going forward, that's really the focus of the conversation with the Environmental Protection Agency, is that we want to fix the system we have, be environmentally responsible, and by addressing our aged wastewater infrastructure, it accomplishes that because we certainly want to be good environmental stewards.
Andy, do you ever foresee a time when water rates could actually drop again?
I do not actually see that being possible. It's a water utility. It's a rising cost industry. Flint, Michigan certainly put a big spotlight on the needs to address our drinking water infrastructure. And so it costs money to run that utility. A wastewater is in the same boat.
How much have our water rates gone up over the last 9 years?
Oh, about, that's kind of a, it's almost a trick question, but I'll answer it. The rates themselves have increased about 290% since 2009.
And this was forecast when the decree was signed, right? We all knew this was going to happen.
That is correct, because meeting the requirements of the Clean Water Act, it's the law. So, and we fund that here in Kansas City. There are not federal funds provided and to meet the requirements of the Clean Water Act.
So absolutely no dollars from the federal government are coming into this program, even though this is a federal government requirement that we're attempting to meet here.
That is correct. That's why you see the rising costs in the water bills, because we are required to meet the Clean Water Act. And so we are funding those needed capital improvements to reduce the volume and frequency of sewer overflows.
Didn't the federal government used to help out with these kinds of projects, and maybe that's gone away in the last decade or so?
Remember, the solution to pollution used to be dilution. So the answer to your question, in the late 60s, early 70s, yes, the federal government provided funds to build wastewater treatment plants at that point in time. But after that initial funding, there has not been funding provided.
So we missed the boat maybe on a chance to get this done more cheaply years ago.
I don't know if that's necessarily accurate. You know, combined sewer systems is quite common. There's some 770 plus cities in the United States that have combined sewer systems. So separating them out is not the cheapest answer to solving the problem. So that's why we look at other technologies, so we do it in the most cost-efficient manner.
Are other cities doing the same thing that we're doing right now, Andy?
Yes, I think there's approximately 150 active consent decrees.
So we're not alone here.
We are not alone. Frankly, the United States as a whole is from a wastewater infrastructure perspective, I think from a drinking water infrastructure perspective, has completely underfunded those needs. It would be nice if the federal government would provide funds to address our infrastructure in the United States. You see infrastructure provided for roads, for highways, but there's not been that level for the water utility or for the wastewater utility or the stormwater utility.
Andy Shively is my guest. He works for the city of Kansas City, Missouri. He's sort of the point person on all things consent decree for this massive sewer project the city is undergoing right now. If you have a quick question for us, 816-235-2888 is our number. Tweet us at KCUR up to date. Andy, how much hardship is this causing around the city? Because just from reading the newspaper, it sounds like it's been a lot.
It's been quite hard on our lowest income families.
People skipping showers, from what I've read.
They have reduced water usage. They have done everything possible in their homes and so they can pay the water bill. So Kansas City's poverty rate is higher than the national average. The national average is about 14%. Kansas City's poverty rate is 17%. Mm. And so it has hit our low-income families the hardest. They're having difficulty paying their water bills, and that's why the mayor and council and city manager have asked that we go back to the Environmental Protection Agency and find a new plan for Kansas City going forward.
When do you expect to get some sort of signal from the EPA as to whether it'll go along with what you'd like to see happen here?
We've already started our talks and negotiations with the Environmental Protection Agency. I think it is important to note that it's not a very quick process. We have had two prior modifications to our consent decree. The first modification took 22 months. Mm. The second modification took 18 months. So I would say it's about a 12 to 18 month process. The Environmental Protection Agency is aware that we need relief now, so we have asked if there is a way to expedite that from the timelines associated with the prior two modifications. We would be very grateful. And they have already, I think, taken steps on their side to help streamline that process, do processes in parallel rather than sequential in order to help us with that timeline. Because like I say, they live and work in this region too, and they are just as concerned with what they hear from the public.
I should point out there's a program to help people with their bills if it's needed. I'm wondering how much help is available out there because the program only has limited dollars attached to it, right?
That is correct. Dollars are provided to the Mid-America Assistance Coalition, and our residents can contact them. But what I hear is that those dollars go fairly quickly, and they don't go very far. If the federal government could provide funds for rate relief in that regard, in other words, will they provide public agencies with the dollars so they can help their low-income families pay for those utilities? That would be great as well.
Let's go to some phone calls here as we talk about Kansas City's massive sewer project and rising water rates in Kansas City. Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Al, good morning.
Good morning. Good topic, since water is life, right?
Yep.
So how has federal oversight really changed since the Reagan administration? Reagan pretty much eliminated any kind of federal oversight for water management. The EPA is a separate issue altogether. So I'm just wondering if you can comment on how under Reagan, the federal oversight was pretty much discontinued and left to the decision-making of the municipalities and the states. So how has that affected this situation we're looking at?
And the question, how has the federal government's role changed when it comes to sewer oversight, Andy?
Really, their role has not changed at all. They ensure that the requirements of the Clean Water Act are adhered to, and that role has not changed over time. It's the same today as it was yesterday, but they do understand that there are affordability concerns, and they're working with Kansas City on the same side of the table to address those concerns.
Ian from the Waldo neighborhood. Ian, good morning.
Good morning. I was really just curious about what priority level putting in new storm drainage systems are. So I'm in the South Waldo area, and I know that we have practically no storm drainage on residential streets.
Stormwater drainage in the Waldo neighborhood, Andy.
So the federal consent decree does not address stormwater management or flood control.
This is just wastewater.
It's a wet weather solution, meaning during rain, for wastewater. And it also addresses our separate sewer system to prevent separate sanitary sewer overflows, but it does not address flood control or stormwater in that regard.
Once this project is completed, will Brush Creek's water be clean once again?
The water quality indeed will be improved. So I think clean is a relative term.
Okay.
So
it won't be drinkable.
Won't be drinkable.
No.
No, it will not.
Yeah. Is it getting better now?
It's
slowly.
It's an incremental process. It took us 150 years to get in this position, and we won't make that change overnight. And so that's what we're working towards, is improving water quality in all of our local streams and rivers.
Final question here from Clinton from North Kansas City. Clinton, good morning.
Good morning. I had a basic question about how citizens can work together with the city. It sounds like the, if I'm understanding the issue correctly, is that our combined water system mixes rainwater with sewage water when it rains heavy. And I'm wondering if there are any moves to maybe help citizens be able to do things like rainwater collections on an individual basis, decrease the flow of rainwater, and then they can use that water to water the lawns, that kind of stuff, reduce the amount of water that's being used. Because I know there are some city ordinances that prohibit that in certain areas, as well as a lot of homes associations that prohibit that. I was wondering if the city is looking into maybe enabling the citizens of the city to be able to help with the problem instead of just being part of the problem.
What can citizens do, Andy?
Great question, Clinton. Thanks for bringing that up. So Kansas City's has a smart sewer program that ensures compliance with our consent decree. So our smart sewer program is developing a public-private partnership program to work with residents and our local businesses so they can capture rainwater on site. So for local residents, we're looking at reviving the rain garden program. You remember many years ago there was quite a push to install 10,000 rain gardens in Kansas City.
Right.
So that public-private partnership to encourage and perhaps help finance or provide some level of funding for rain barrels, rain gardens for private residents, and then for businesses, if it's a cost-effective solution to store on private property, to keep that rainwater coming off of the private property and entering the public combined sewer system, then to provide funding in that manner. So that program is being developed right now, because you're absolutely correct. Some 470,000 people in Kansas City, more than 170,000 households. If everybody would participate, that would be huge.
We'll have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Andy Shively again, Special Assistant City Manager, the point person on this consent decree, for a great conversation on what's going on. Andy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Time for a break. When we come back, our ethics professors will be here. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow we'll talk about one of the wettest and wickedest cities during Prohibition. That'd be good old Kansas City. You can join us for that conversation tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, get this. When the Vice President, Mike Pence, makes an appearance at this year's NRA Leadership Forum on Friday, guns are banned. Yes, you heard that right. We'll find out in just a moment what our ethics professors think about that. Another issue for our deep-thinking professors, should the federal government prohibit welfare recipients from using welfare benefits to buy soda or candy or anything deemed unhealthy? The ethics professors are in the house, and they're joined by one very special guest today. They are Wayne Vaught. He's the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC and a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics. He's one of my bosses on campus. Wayne, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Good to be here.
Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. Clancy, always good to have you.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
Also with us today is Isabel Gussman. She's a junior at Shawnee Mission South High School and a member of that school's Missouri High School Ethics Bowl team this year. Isabel, welcome to you, too.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Vice President Mike Pence is in Dallas tomorrow for this NRA convention, and it turns out the convention has banned guns during the Vice President's appearance. Students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where 17 people were killed during a mass shooting on Valentine's Day, are highly critical of this. One student wrote on Twitter, "Wait, wait, 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 you're telling me to make the vice president safe and there aren't any weapons around, but when it comes to children, they want guns everywhere? Can someone explain this to me?" Wayne, can you explain it?
I can't explain it very easily, other than the fact is recognition that there is some justification for saying that there are certain places where guns are inappropriate. And the argument that has been forwarded by certain advocates of gun rights is that guns should be everywhere, anywhere that anyone wants to carry them. So it does raise this bit of irony that in tomorrow, the one place you can't carry a gun is at an NRA convention. And so that does, and I doubt seriously that it was probably the NRA leadership's decision, probably had to do more with Secret Services and
protections. That's exactly what this was.
Of the president. And so they probably had to, if they were going to have him there, that was a condition in which they had to do it. So it probably wasn't their thinking. But it does raise the specter of the fact is that there are places where guns are inappropriate, and there is certainly a conversation that needs to be had in this country about the appropriate use, appropriate regulations, appropriate restrictions on guns. And this kind of, I think, puts it and highlights it in a way that these Parkland students are right to point out. It's like there is some real inconsistency here. We want a safe place, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to know that we're safe. And if safety means not having guns, then why can't it be here just like it is there?
Isabel, how does all this strike you?
I mean, especially from a student's standpoint, I do feel like there is a lot of irony that, you know, the NRA is not allowing guns to be, I guess, available during this convention.
Right.
It's really contradictory. And I mean, it is pretty inconsistent with the NRA's beliefs and Pence's beliefs.
But do students at your high school feel unsafe these days, given all the mass shootings we've had in recent years?
We've had a lot of discussions about it in class. I have a U.S. history class, and we hold current events every Friday. And we always talk about how, you know, should or should not guns be allowed in schools? How is our safety being, you know, violated in this act?
Yeah. You know, Clancy, on this show over the years, we've talked about exceptions to so many beliefs and rules that are out there. When can exceptions be made to strongly held beliefs like this idea that guns should be allowed just about anywhere, which is what the NRA in broad terms has espoused over recent years? But when can you make exceptions to these things?
Well, it seems to me that this is a case very clearly where guns shouldn't be present. And I think there
are... A vice president's appearance.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think, I'm in complete agreement with the decision not to have guns there. I think, however, it should cause us to reflect. I wouldn't say it's merely irony. I think it's just like blatant hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. That on the part of several parties involved in this, I think it's an excellent decision. It's very unusual and surprising decision, and I hope it has.
Because as soon as you open the door to this one exception, the question, as Isabel points out and as Wayne points out,
there's might be room for lots of exceptions. Yes, here. That's been the whole debate.
Right. The question of exceptions and to, you know, morally consistent principles, there are some kinds of exceptions where we would say we can provide we can make an exception that is nevertheless consistent with a kind of larger policy. This doesn't seem to be one of those cases. This seems to be kind of straightforward enactment of hypocrisy on the part of the NRA, on the part of Pence, on the part of, at some level, frankly, our political establishment on this question of the American relationship with guns. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for it because I think we, as a parent who has children in school right now and who feels very acutely this worry that we are not taking this problem seriously in the way that we should. I mean, it meant so much to me when, after one of the countless mass shootings that we've had, President Barack Obama was almost brought to tears at the podium. And they were tears of frustration that he could not get people to see clearly on this issue and couldn't get Congress to act contrary to their own very narrow political and financially motivated self-interests, controlled by the incredibly powerful lobbying of the NRA. And so I think the gross hypocrisy of the NRA is on vivid public display right now. And the more we can be talking about it, arguing about it, pointing it out, the more hope there is that students, in particular, the concerns of these students can help us arrive at a somewhat more rational and consistent gun policy in this country.
Isabel Clancy just used an interesting word, frustration, with this ongoing debate over gun control. How much frustration do you sense amongst your fellow students at Shawnee Mission South?
I mean, especially with this issue at hand with, you know, again, the hypocrisy in the NRA not allowing the guns at the convention, I feel like we should be taking advantage of that. And in calling the NRA out, calling Pence out and saying, hey, you're violating your own beliefs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that should be handled
that way. Let's go to a different topic here, everybody. The Farm Bill, which is always a gigantic piece of legislation, is currently making its way through Congress. Included in it is money for SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which helps very low or no-income Americans pay for food. My question, Wayne Vaught, should we let SNAP recipients buy whatever food or drink they see fit, or should the federal government weigh in here and ban the purchase of unhealthy foods, pop, soda, you know, candy, alcohol, that kind of thing?
I would argue that it's a reasonable restriction on the type of purchases that could be made through this particular program. It is a supplemental nutrition program, so it is the purpose of this is to ensure that there is a base minimum of access to nutrition, healthy foods, dietary needs to meet the basic needs of those who don't have them. So to think that they would be used for purchasing empty calories, non-nutritional purchases, non-nutritional foods, I think does raise a concern, particularly with that specific program, given what the program is supposed to accomplish. So it would be, I think, in some sense contradictory to the purpose of the program to just allow kind of wholesale buying of certainly alcoholic beverages and other types of things. So I would think that an ethical argument could certainly be made that it's appropriate to have these restrictions on recipients of the benefits of this program in terms of the types of food purchases they might be able to
make. You know, Clancy Martin, the argument here, though, is that poor folks like to eat a little junk food once in a while, too. They like to have a glass of wine after a stressful day, and arguably poor folks have more stress in their lives than a lot of people do. What about that?
Well, I do think that we need to be careful. This, here again, your worry about moral exceptions is relevant. I think we need to be careful about exercising our paternalism consistently. So it's true we have a surprisingly high degree for paternalism in America. Paternalistic laws are laws like seatbelt laws, helmet laws, these kinds of things, which Americans have a kind of knee-jerk reaction against, but we're more tolerant than we sometimes like to pretend of these paternalistic laws. What we don't want to do is to be selectively paternalistic so that we're picking out a particular segment of the population and saying, well, we're going to allow ourselves to say what you, this segment of the population, perhaps a marginalized segment of the population, a population that doesn't have a very robust political voice right now. And then we're going to be more libertarian when we're thinking about questions such as how you get to spend your health savings accounts, let's say, where we're not going to be paternalistic. I mean, I'm always shocked. I myself have one of these health savings accounts, and I'm shocked at the range of different services I can access with this tax-free credit card. Shocked because I know that if I were not squarely in the middle class, I wouldn't be able to put this money aside, and I wouldn't be able to just walk in and buy myself a fancy pair of glasses with this credit card tax-free, or I wouldn't be able to walk into CVS and get XYZ tax-free. So I'm with Wayne. Some paternalism here is appropriate, but let's make sure we're being consistently paternalistic across socioeconomic spectra in all the varieties of government benefit programs which we provide.
Now, Isabel, what do you think here? Should the federal government weigh in here and dictate to welfare recipients the kinds of foods they can buy with their welfare benefits versus what they can't buy?
I mean, with all the, I guess, the amount of people that can't access certain things like vitamins or any tangible necessities such as soap or maybe even alcohol, I feel like maybe we need to give a little leeway to those people that cannot access those. And maybe just in general, like maybe if we, especially the mentally ill, they don't have the capacity to access certain foods or certain things. They're not able-bodied enough. So I feel like we need to help them a lot more.
Oh, that's interesting.
And especially with federally funded public welfare systems, I feel like we need to give a little leverage to those people that, you know, aren't able-bodied enough to access those necessities.
Do you think we're sending a degrading message to these welfare recipients by dictating to them, hey, Mr. or Mrs. Welfare Recipient, you can buy this, you can't buy that? There's a heavy-handed message there, isn't there?
Well, in part, other than I don't know that it is as so paternalistic as to wanting to say, hey, you can't do this, this, or this. And I think Clancy's point is right on, that we're allowing the use of tax rebates, basically, to allow certain people of certain privilege to do certain types of things by the not just the basic pair of glasses, but a much fancier pair of glasses. Here, I guess, you know, the question has to become, what's the program supposed to be accomplishing? And we're providing funds to accomplish a particular end goal. And the end goal, and at least with these food assistance programs, is to ensure that people have a base nutritional value in their diets and they get access to that nutrition. And candy bars, sodas, potato chips, these
don't
types of
that.
Products are not accomplishing what the goal of that particular program is supposed to accomplish. Now, if it were just a, hey, we're giving you funds and you should go out and do it, I think it becomes a little more paternalistic in that sense. But here, I think that you could still make a compelling ethical argument that we're not trying to be paternalistic. You can buy whatever you want from a range of nutritionally appropriate food products. You just can't buy things that are outside that nutritional range because it then doesn't allow us to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish.
Clancy, go quickly if you would.
I just wanted to add that, unfortunately, Wayne's argument there presupposes that these people have access to this range of nutritionally adequate products. And
sometimes
it's simply the case.
Food deserts where they don't have access to it.
Yeah, it's quite common for people in this
the
people who are intended to benefit from these programs just don't have access to, and that's a further thing that needs to be addressed by the program.
Okay, we'll have to thank our ethics professors and leave it right there. Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin from UMKC and Isabel Gussman, a junior at Shawnee Mission South High School, did a great job.
I think you
schooled our ethics professors here today.
I feel like I
learned something.
You put them in their
definitely.
Place,
Isabel.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the overcrowded Douglas County Jail. I'm Steve Kraske. and you are up to date.